You are listening to an Emmanuel Community Church podcast. For more sermons or information about the church, visit our website at www.emmanuelcommunity.org.
Some years ago, a young couple from our church wanted to be married, and we did all the premarital counseling and all of that, and she wanted to have her uncle, who was a retired pastor, do the wedding, which we're thrilled about when people can put family members in and be part of that. And so she asked me to assist and him to lead the wedding, and I was happy to do so. So the evening of the rehearsal arrived, and we came to the front. Now, her grandfather was, as I said, retired. He had not done weddings in quite some time. He was very soft-spoken. And so we stood here at the front while people were milling around. It was supposed to start at 6:30. It was now 6:45, 6:50, 6:55. Gets past 7 o'clock. He says, "Okay, we ought to get started." And nobody did anything, of course. And a few minutes later, "Okay, now let's all meet in the front." And nobody moved. So it's now 7:15. And I leaned over to him and I said, "Would you want me to lead the rehearsal?" And he goes, "Would you please?" So God gifted me with a spiritual gift when I became a pastor of my whistle. And so many of you have heard it. I'll be gentle. But, you know, everybody's milling around. I went, and everybody, and that was a kind one, by the way. And everybody jumped to attention. I said, "Okay, here's what we're going to do. Groomsmen, I want you right up here on the floor. Groom up here on the platform, bridesmaids back in the back, dad and bride back there on the other door. The music starts in 30 seconds, the rehearsal's over in 30 minutes. Go!" Boom! It was over in less than 30 minutes. And afterwards, by the way, all of us have been in those situations where you think, "Will someone please take charge?" But most of us, myself included, don't want to take charge. You know, it's like, I don't want to do that, but somebody needs to. And then what always amazes me is after the rehearsal, people walk up and say, "Oh, thank you. Somebody needed to take charge here." Well, if I could describe to you today's passage of Scripture, honestly, that's how I'd describe it. The Apostle Paul is now kind of to his wit's end. He has talked to them about how they should use their spiritual gifts in the church and how they ought to love each other and so forth, and he's done it in a very kind way. But in a sense, in verse 26, he's going to whistle and say, "Okay, tongue speakers, two or three only over here. Prophets, two or three only over here. If anybody gets a revelation, you stand up, everybody else sits down." And that's basically what I'm going to teach you. He just said, "Here are the rules, let's live by them." And by the way, at the end he says, "And if you don't agree with me, you're wrong." So it's about as clear as you can get it. Now, I want to show you and just remind you today that we're at the end of this series, and we're at the end of every series that we've done in 1 Corinthians. We're all finished. We started on January the 8th. I'll review that with you next week. And next week we'll do chapter 16, which won't be a series. It's just a kind of a way of Paul saying goodbye and giving some final instruction. So today is the last, and I will say this, a little bit of a caution today, because it is a bit heavy. Some of you like it when we dig deeper, and some of you like it when we don't dig so deep. And I just want to say to you, I don't know how to deal with this passage without taking you to some deeper places that some of you may really appreciate and others may find difficult. That's okay. But I do think it's an important passage of Scripture for us to study together. I think you're going to be fine. And next week, it's a real easy one, and after that, it's the Christmas series. So you got a few weeks to relax. This one, we're going to put our thinking caps on, and we're going to work, okay? So grab your Bibles. Dig in with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 14. We're going to start with verse 26, go all the way to the end of the chapter, and I'm going to break it down into three sections this morning. As most of you know, it's been a kind of a sad week in different ways for our church. One is that last Saturday, just over a week ago, Jocelyn Bloom, Joe, passed away. Went into the hospital not expecting there to be anything really that serious, and just never quite recovered. And so funeral was yesterday here at Emmanuel, And we'll miss her. They've been involved here at Emmanuel for more than 10 years. They've been involved in various kinds of ministry, each of them using their spiritual gifts. And so we'll miss Joe. Also this past week, Dan Best passed away. Dan has been here again maybe 10 years or close to 10 years, ushered. Many of you probably knew him as an usher. He passed away this week, and viewing will be tomorrow, funeral service on Tuesday morning. Dan, neat guy, involved in so many things. In fact, one winter's day, late winter's day, he called me and said, "Do you want to come out and see how maple syrup is made?" And I said, "Sure." So we went out into the woods somewhere. I don't know where we were. And we tapped trees, and it was just so fun to learn from him, and he had a good life. And so I just want you to be aware of these two losses. Pray for families. Encourage them. Cards, taking them out to eat or lunch or coffee, just whatever you can do to encourage these families, we encourage you to do so. Okay, I want to start today maybe a little differently. Instead of with the two main thoughts, I'd like to start with a little bit of a review. Not in your notes, so just hang with me a minute. A couple weeks ago, we learned that Paul said there are kinds, kinds, kinds. He used the word three times because he wanted you to understand that not everybody has the same giftedness. He used the words gifts, services, and workings, which is very interesting because we only call them gifts, but he says, no, they serve each other, and that's the way you work. And he says they're given by the triune God, Spirit, Jesus Christ, and the Father. So your gifts couldn't come from a higher source or authority. On the back of your notes, I gave you the same chart that I gave you a few weeks back. And that's this chart that shows you three different kinds of gifts that we have in the Bible. Now, please understand, I'm not saying this is Paul's list. I don't know exactly how Paul's chart would play out, but this is my best guess. And so on the far left, you have the sign gifts. In the middle, you have the speaking gifts. And on the right, you have the serving gifts. All of these gifts have been listed in chapters 12 and 13 of 1 Corinthians. Now we're dealing with how you process them. The issue here today in chapter 14 at the end is just the use of two specific gifts. One is speaking in tongues, and we'll get to that in just a moment. The other is prophecy. Now, here's the problem, and I just want to correct something, because this is something I should have caught and I didn't catch. The gift of prophecy is two different kinds of a gift. It's a sign gift in 1 Corinthians. It's a speaking gift in Romans. So at the bottom of that left column, I've added, and if you want to write it in, I've added the word prophecy. And you see we have prophecy now twice, but it's because it's used differently. And I'll show you that today. So if I would take my circle now, I would just move it down over to here and say, we're talking about two gifts, both sign gifts, the speaking in tongues and the gift of prophecy is what we're learning about today. We know that every believer has gifts. Every one of you who is a Christian has gifts. I hope you're using them. In fact, we learned that we're all part of one body. Human body was the illustration. We're all, you know, a finger or a toe or an ear or whatever. And God says the human body needs all its parts and the church needs all its parts. So everybody do your part. Okay, let's kind of be reminded. The two thoughts that I wanted you to hold on to from this series is simply this. The ultimate aim of the church is to be loving. I mean, if you have a wonderful spiritual gift, great. If you have a gift that everybody acknowledges as one of the great gifts, good for you. And if you use it well, good for you. Be known, though, for loving. That's what you want to be known for. Secondly, the purpose of your spiritual gifts is for other people. We live in a world that everything I do is for me. At least that seems to be the attitude of people. I have to do for me. Nobody else is going to take care of me, so I better take care of me. It's the selfie generation, right? And so I just want to remind you that your spiritual gifts are never for you. Your spiritual gifts are for other people. And so that's obviously how you want to think about using them. Now, I put a chart on the front of your notes today. Not normally would I do this because I just didn't know how to show this to you. So I thought maybe best this way, maybe you'll find a better way to to communicate this to someone else. The Apostle Paul wrote 13 letters of the New Testament, maybe 14 if he wrote Hebrews, no one knows. He wrote some of the earliest ones in the late 40s and early 50s AD. He wrote his latest ones 64, 65, in that range, no one knows exactly the year, but about 10 to 12 years later. His earliest books, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians and 1st and 2nd Corinthians, contain these kind of things. Two or three prophets should speak. If anyone thinks they are a prophet, the use of the sign gift of prophecy is mentioned. Now, keep in mind, the people that he's writing to, both the Thessalonians and the Corinthians, as we've been studying, they're the first Christians in Europe. No one's ever heard of Christianity. Let me take you to the map and just remind you that down here is where it all began, where Jesus lived and died and rose again, and the gospel spread from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria and then to the ends of the earth, right? And so Paul began the first missionary journeys, and he traveled through what is today Turkey, but in those days was called Asia Minor. That was his first missionary journey. His second missionary journey, he went back and did the same thing, basically the same circle, but he comes to the very west coast of what we know as Turkey today, and he goes, God, now what? And we read the story of a vision of a man from Macedonia. Now, Macedonia is today's Greece, and the man says, come over here. And this is hard for us to kind of grasp, but this is today's Asia, right? And as soon as you cross that little bit of water, you're in Europe. And so for the first time ever, as far as we know, Christianity crosses the water to Philippi and so forth, down through Thessalonica, and all the way down to Corinth, where Paul lives a year and a half. Now you see, these people have never heard of Christianity. They don't know Jesus. They don't have a Bible. The New Testament hasn't been written. They don't even know the stories. So when they get together for church, what are you going to read? Who's going to tell the stories? Who's going to proclaim the word? We don't have it. So in those days, someone had to supernaturally stand up with their gift and prophesy. Now, that doesn't mean tell the future. It means speak in God's behalf, speak for God, his mouthpiece. And some people spoke in tongues, languages that could be interpreted. And that was so amazing that God gave that gift, because what else are you going to do? Now, years pass. Let me just explain it this way. I once coached a little league baseball team, and it was the first year of this league. And so I had all nine-year-olds. Now, when you have all nine-year-olds, they would, you know, hit the ball and run to third. And so you'd have to bring them back and run to first and so forth. And so it was all like teaching. It was work. The next year, I had some 10-year-olds. And the next year, I had some 11-year-olds. And the next year, some 12-year-olds. And you know what I realized? My work got so much easier because the older ones taught the younger ones, and I didn't have to do the teaching anymore. That's exactly what happens here. As Christians grow up in their faith, and the Bible starts to be written, and the letters being sent by Paul, the people start to grow in their faith. And you suddenly go through this time of now offices. In fact, we get to Timothy and Titus, and prophecy is never mentioned, never once. You know what is mentioned? Elders. Elders and pastors. Because time has now changed. You don't need the same supernatural communication from God. You have it in his holy word. And of course, people teaching one another. Now, I just want you to see that, because the whole idea that the communication has changed drastically. Never again will you see the word prophecy in this kind of way, as you'll see it here. Let me read to you the section. This is where Paul whistles, if you would, and says, okay, here's the rules. Follow along. What then shall we say, brothers and sisters? When you come together, each of you has a hymn or a word of instruction, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Everything must be done so that the church may be built up. If anyone speaks in a tongue, two or at the most three should speak, one at a time, and someone must interpret. If there is no interpreter, the speaker should keep quiet in the church and speak to himself and to God. Two or three prophets should speak, and the others should weigh carefully what is being said. And if a revelation comes to someone who is sitting down, the first speaker should stop, for you can all prophesy in turn, so that everyone may be instructed and encouraged. The spirits of the prophet are subject to the control of the prophets, for God is not a God of disorder, but of peace. As in all the congregations of the Lord's people, therefore, my brothers, and I'm jumping here because the last verse is connected to the main portion of Scripture, which is what Paul often does. So let me just jump to the end. Therefore, my brothers and sisters, be eager to prophesy. Do not forbid speaking in tongues, but everything should be done in a fitting and orderly way. Now, just to give you a little bit of cultural context, the people in Corinth have been worshiping. They have been, quote, going to church, right? But they've been going to pagan temples. There is a whole group of deities, what they called the mystery religions. Many of them didn't even know what exactly they were worshiping. And so it was very mysterious and very mystical. And so they'd go into their temples and they would all be noisy. They'd all speak at the same time and they'd use some kind of a babbling tongue, a tongue that they didn't understand and they believed that the gods understood. They took symbols and banged them together. We're just a group who was involved in chaos, celebrating pagan holidays, usually around agriculture. Sexual sin was involved. Prostitution was involved. I mean, that's how they knew church. Now, you take them into a Christian church, and this is what they're used to, so you have to help them say, okay, we don't worship like that anymore. So how do we worship? Well, Paul makes it real clear. The conclusion of the matter is, everything we do is to build the church. He says that in verse 26. He says it in verse 12, all the way back when he started. Do those things or excel in those things that build up the church. So the conclusion of the matter, here's what we do. We work to build the church together. By the way, one little phrase I want you to see. What then shall we say? I want to show you two phrases today that Paul uses all the time. He'll say, he'll finish a topic and go, what then shall we say? What is the conclusion? The conclusion is, let's build the church. Now, here are the rules. If you're a tongue speaker, it should be limited to two or three people speaking and not at the same time. And by the way, when you speak in that tongue, there must be an interpreter. Now, here's a very interesting, in a sense, dilemma. If anyone speaks in a tongue, I told you last week that in the King James translation, they took every time you found the word tongue singular and they added the word unknown because that was considered whatever was the prayer language that people would speak. It didn't have an actual interpretation to it. It was just a prayer language. On the other hand, if the word tongues was used, it was understood to be a literal, like, human language, like English or German or French or whatever, okay? Now, here's the exception, and this exception, I hope, is not just to be convenient. I hope it makes sense. Let me show you. If anyone, singular, speaks in a tongue. Now, I believe this is tongues, the real language, because it's going to be interpreted, right? So it has to be language. But in this case, he uses the singular word tongue because he's using the singular person. If anyone, because one person would not speak in six tongues, they would speak in one different language. If anyone speaks in a tongue, two at the most, and make sure that there's an interpreter. There's the rules. These tongues were used to help communicate the gospel of Jesus Christ to maybe people of different languages who wouldn't have understood it otherwise. Prophecy speakers, you should also be limited to two or three of you. Others should be testing what you said. You know what I've learned with like reading to children or reading in a youth setting when I'm teaching? I'll often say, now, I'm going to read this to you, but will you look for the word? And you know, that keeps people engaged with you. If you get them to watch for something, they stay engaged. And so that's what Paul's doing here. It's very parental in his teaching. He says, the others of you should weigh carefully what is said. So there's lots of prophets in the church. All of you want to speak, I know, says Paul, but I only want two or at the most three to speak, one at a time, and the rest of you check what they're saying. Make sure it's accurate. If another person receives a revelation, boy, there's a big word. That's the word apocalyptus, or in this case, apocalypto. This is that word we know as the apocalypse, right? By the way, you won't see this word again used by an individual in the church in the Bible. Only used here because it was so essential at this point in time. It won't be used again. It'll be used of Jesus Christ. In fact, the last book of our Bible will be called, right? The Revelation. And at the end of it, it says, no one should add to or take away from. See, nobody gets revelation anymore. If you'd come up to me and say, you know, when you were speaking, I got a revelation, I'd probably just stop you and say, I think you got an inspiration. Nobody gets a revelation today. The revelation was given to those who wrote the scriptures. They put it down. No one adds to the end, to the book of Revelation. No one adds to or takes away from this book. But in these days, revelation was essential. And so Paul says, if anyone receives a revelation, then everybody else get quiet. Sit down. And the person who has the revelation, please speak. But we don't want people speaking at the same time. Now, what's the whole point here? Obviously, is let's be orderly. Do everything in an orderly way. Use the gifts that God gave you. Use them powerfully. But remember that God is defined as a God of peace. He's not a God of chaos. So let's not be chaotic when we come to church. I know that's the way you knew. That's the pagan way. That's okay for them, not okay for us. I just want to show you that last verse one more time. Verse 39 and 40, the last verse. But everything should be done in a fitting and orderly way. Now that's just the bottom line of this whole stretch. Do everything in a fitting. The word fitting there is a Greek word that could mean beautiful, wonderful. In this case, it's a fitting and orderly way. There's the point. Now we come to a section of scripture that has been very divisive in churches, and many of you have read it and wondered about it and wondered what it means and how you should interpret it. I just want to say before I even read it, this is not a big issue to me. This is not a hill I want to die on, so don't try to kill me for this. This is something that I think is part of the scriptures, so you know very well I won't skip it. It's something we need to process, but I think we can process it in multiple ways, and I want to show you that. So follow along as I read. Women should remain silent in the churches. They are not allowed to speak, but must be in submission as the law says. If they want to inquire about something, they should ask their own husbands at home, for it is disgraceful for a woman to speak in the church. Or did the word of God originate with you, or are you the only people it has reached? Now, many interpretations of this, and so I'm going to give you three that are similar. By the way, I found 9 different interpretations this week. A couple of them to me just seem so far-fetched. So I want to show you 4 that I think are the most plausible, at least in my mind. One view of this 3 verses is that those verses don't even belong here. That somewhere along the line, someone who had an agenda against women just inserted this into the Bible. Now, why would people even say that? Well, because it is true that some manuscripts actually put these 3 verses at the end of the chapter, separate, almost like a little, you know, paragraph marker and then these 3 verses. And so it is true that in some manuscripts it's in the text and some manuscripts it's below the text. But I will say this. By the way, some people don't think it fits here because it doesn't fit with the idea of spiritual gifts. But in my opinion, it does fit with the idea of orderly, doing things orderly. But again, there are no manuscripts ever been found that do not have these verses included. So if you say, well, they shouldn't be there, let's pull them out, please understand there is no historical archaeological evidence for that. They may have been placed below instead of within, but they're always there. So, a second view is this. Corinthian women were known for being disorderly because of their pagan worship and pagan traditions. And they were shouting and they were all talking at the same time. And these verses are unique to the issues in Corinth. I kind of said this earlier, but we all kind of get accustomed to the way we worship, right? So if you've worshiped in these temples for the last 30 years, maybe you were a kid when you started, and you grew up with that tradition, it's hard to change. Some of you have come from a Catholic tradition in your upbringing, and you struggle sometimes with worship because you kind of long for the way maybe that parts of what you did before. I grew up, from the time I can remember, I grew up in a church that had beautiful vaulted ceilings, spectacular, and I mean incredible, stained glass windows all the way around with scripture in them. We had colored lights that hang from the ceiling. It was gorgeous. It was like a little cathedral. I grew up in that. And of course, when we'd sing, we'd take our hymn books, and we'd open our hymn books, and we would then sing parts because we had our parts there listed. And I think there were 500 hymns, and I knew every one of them. And there are times, I will say, that I kind of miss that place that I worshiped and the style of worship. By the way, I don't long for it. Love what we do now. But there are times I think, there are parts of that I kind of miss. That's because that's how I grew up. This is how these people grew up. You can't hardly blame them for the way they've been acting in church, and now they go to church and they got to behave differently. So, makes sense. Maybe this is to Corinthian women only. Now, a third view, and one that's kind of like the second one, is just that this has to do with just the first century. And in the first century, women couldn't own property and didn't have the same rights as men. And so Paul was using that because Jewish men, although Jewish people treated women better than most, there was still this secondary citizen kind of feeling with women. And so maybe this is cultural from a male-female first century perspective. Now, if any of these three first interpretations I just gave you ring with you, that you think, yeah, that's great, that's fine. Now, I'm going to show you the fourth one, which is not as obviously popular, right? The fourth view is that it is the pattern for worship for all time. It was not cultural. It is for 1,000 years ago, it is for today, and it's for 1,000 years from now. That it is the plan that God has designed for men and women in the church setting. Why? Because that's why he created us. He created us that way, and I'm going to read that to you in just a moment. Now, let me show you something that I think is quite interesting. Verse 33 says, God is not a God of disorder, but of peace. And then there's a dash there. There are no dashes. There are no periods. There are no capital letters in the Greek. So you never know what kind of punctuation to put where. And then it says, as in all the congregation of the Lord's people. The first part of the phrase is God's character. He is not a God of disorder, but of peace. That's who he is. And so it doesn't make sense to say, as in all the congregations, because that's who he is everywhere, all the time. So some people would say that there needs to be another space there. Just move that down. As in all the congregations of the Lord's people, women should remain silent in the churches, which then I think the phrase itself makes a little more sense. A woman, says 1 Timothy, in the book of 1 Timothy, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. Why? Not for cultural reason. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. Adam was not the one deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and became a sinner. And so Paul doesn't hearken back to culture. He harkens back to creation. I want to show you this chart that I showed you first again, but I'm changing the text. Again, when Paul wrote to Corinth, he writes this about women silent in churches. 12 years later, as he moved from, as you know, prophecy to pastors and teachers, here he has this text in 1 Corinthians. He has the same text in 1 and 2 Timothy. And so that is something that appears not to have changed. So what do you deal with? How do you deal with it? Well, the word speaking here would indicate someone who is the speaker of the assembly, someone who, like, would be in my place today. I think the funny thing about this one is that, do you realize men or women, no one ever asks me if they can speak? No one ever comes to me on a Sunday and says, can I speak today? In fact, when I tease some of you and go, would you like to preach this morning? No. And I understand, it's not your job. You haven't prepared, and maybe you've not been called to that particular office and gift. And so today we operate under offices and gifts. And so this is not just a woman thing. This is the idea of office and giftedness. It's also something that you should know in some denominations has become a real, I don't know what to call it, a a touch point issue, an issue that just kind of divides people. And so some denominations are really promoting putting women in senior pastoral roles, and our own denomination ordains men and women. Fine, I've known that all my life, no problem. But you see, it is a struggle in churches. But if we look at it from a gifted position or an office position, it's not as big a deal. Secondly, to keep order in the church, a woman is supposed to wait till she gets home and ask her husband. Now, that sounds really unfair, right? It sounds like a woman's not bright enough to understand. And so when she gets home, she better ask her husband so she can figure these things out. Now, one thing I want to say before I explain that to you is that, guys, if you think this is a good idea for women to remain silent, you better have some answers when you get home, right? Don't think, oh, I like what Paul said. If you are not willing to give the answers when you get home, if you go home every week and she says, hey, and you go, I don't know, well, then maybe she shouldn't keep quiet, right? So, guys, you have a responsibility here. Now, let me explain this to you because this is so easy to misunderstand. Why would a woman have to wait till she gets home to ask her husband? Well, where did people sit? Think about it. Just a few years ago, we were in Jerusalem. Our group who we toured with for the last week had flown home, and I had a few days to do some videos for a sermon series I was doing. We were there on a Saturday, and so we were, I bet, four doors from the great synagogue in Jerusalem. Seats thousands of people. Service was going to be that morning, starting at 9 o'clock, and I said to Karen, do you want to go? And she goes, well, let's go look. So we walked up, and I mean, just droves of people going in. And so we walk up and peek in. You know how you do when you don't want to be in, but you want to see. So we kind of peek in, and then we go a couple steps further and keep looking. You couldn't see much, so we kept going a step further. Finally, I went one step too far, and the usher grabs me, says, welcome, come on up. And he puts me in the second row. Now, there's thousands of people there, and I'm in the second row. Now, I never saw my wife again. Because where do the women sit? Well, they sit in a separate section. In fact, in this case, they were on a huge balcony. Now, we sat there for several hours through this service. It was very interesting, but finally, when I had a moment I could get out, I got out, and Karen saw me leaving, so she came downstairs, and we walked out. Guess what happened? She says, hey, why did he do this? And why did he? What did he say when that happened? And so, because, you see, I was close. I could hear things. I could understand things. She was way back. And it's not here a matter of someone being bright and someone else not being so intelligent. It's the issue of the men would sit front and the women would sit back. And it was a Jewish tradition. And Corinth has a lot of Jewish people in it. So that's the issue. You're not sitting with your husband. Paul says, ladies, don't stand up and go, hey, honey, what'd he say? Because that just disrupts church. So don't do that. Wait till you get home. Now, what if you're unmarried? If you're unmarried, well, you could ask a brother or, you know, a friend or whatever. It's not saying you have to be married. It's just saying that's the most common thing that happens is couples would go home, and that's a good place to ask your husband. Thirdly, we're to be faithful to God's design for the home and for the church. God has established two institutions. Two institutions that he has established. That's all. And he's God. And the first one he established was called the family. And he says, not that men are superior in any way, but because there has to be someone who is the one who take the lead, he says the husband will take the lead in a home. And he says, in a church, I want the man to take the lead. Again, not because we are more capable. In fact, my opinion is because we're less capable. That shows that God can work through us. That he has called the men to do this. If anyone thinks they are a prophet or otherwise gifted by the Spirit, let them acknowledge that what I am writing to you is the Lord's command. But if anyone ignores this, they themselves will be ignored. Now, this is the third section. It's just Paul simply saying, I'm going to put my stamp on this. So let me just give you a couple thoughts. Paul concludes with a stern warning. I told you he would often end by saying, what shall we say then? Well, here's another phrase he uses all the time. If anyone thinks they're a prophet, if anyone destroys God's temple, if anyone is worried, that if anyone wants to be contentious. You see, every time he would finish a subject that we've studied in this letter, he would conclude with this because this was like the final point. This is what you better take to the bank. Secondly, he asked those with the gift of prophecy to test what he is saying, affirm those things. Here Paul is speaking as an apostle with authority. Remember how he started the book? Paul called to be an apostle. He tells them that they know of his seal of apostleship. So he says, you know that I am called by God to do this. Now, those of you in the church who have the gift of prophecy, will you read this letter carefully and make sure you test what I'm saying? And his final words are, if you're going to ignore God's plan for order, then you should be ignored. He basically said, what I just told you, I said as an apostle, with all authority, it's right. And so therefore, if you want to ignore what I told you, you ought to be ignored. You ought to be put out of the church. Because this is the way you handle worship. Okay, well, a lot of stuff there in those few verses. So here's how I'd like to end. We're a teaching church. Sometimes you ask why I give you time at the end of the sermon to think or talk, and it's because I think with teaching, that's the unique part of teaching, is there has to be a time of processing. What did I learn? How can I deal with it? And my goal every week is to hit you in the head, in the heart, in the feet. I want to give you something that you can chew on, that you go, I didn't know that, or that's new insight or new perspective. I like to give you something that kind of gets you feeling the sermon. And it could be in a sense of joy or hope, or today the idea that we have peace when we worship together. Or maybe you're angry that Paul said that about women, or that I had the audacity to preach it, or whatever. You know, you want to be involved emotionally or you won't learn. And then lastly, you always have to ask yourself, what's this mean to me? So what? How will I go out of this place, drive out of the parking lot and go, okay, this is how I can be better or different because of what I learned today. So I'm going to give you 2 minutes. I think that's not a lot, but a starting point, and you can continue afterwards. I'm going to give you 2 minutes, and I'd like you to just process it. If you'd like to answer these questions, writing them down, if you'd like to turn to the person you came to church with and discuss them, that's fine. I'm going to give you 2 minutes. They're yours. Are you ready? Go. Okay, don't lose your thought, don't lose your place. Continue talking as you leave today, because that's how we can always learn more. I had some questions last evening. By the way, after this service, I'm going to be out in the worship center lobby. If you have questions about this text, I know it's difficult. Feel free to come over and chat with me. I did have some questions last night from some people, particularly two women who came up to me and said that they held to the fourth interpretation of women in the church, but where does that leave us? You know, how are we serving? And I thought, you know, I didn't explain that very well, probably. In the church body, we have small groups. We have lots of segmented groups. Men are best teaching men and students, youth and children. Women are best teaching women and youth and children. And that way we can probably be most effective. However, when we're together in one place as a corporate body, that's what this text is talking about. So we all still use our gifts of teaching and speaking and so forth, but in different kinds of contexts. And that's, I think, what's maybe so genius about the order of this. So we're going to pray for our team. Come on up, Sam.